This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last night we discussed a medrash on the basis of which I began to develop an idea which I would like to take further this evening. I don't mind repeating it for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's important, and there's no reason why even those who heard it last night shouldn't hear it again tonight. Secondly, there are a lot of people here tonight who weren't there last night. And thirdly, last night was one of those funny droshes where at the end of the drosha, it happens very, very infrequently, but at the end of the drosha, not only wouldn't I be able to tell you if anybody understood what I was talking about, I wouldn't be able to tell you if my audience was English speaking or not. It's just one of those things where you have absolutely no response. Normally you see people don't understand, and you know they didn't understand. Sometimes you see people did understand. Sometimes you see people who are struggling to understand. Sometimes you see some understood, some didn't. Last night I wouldn't know. If you ask me, did they understand, didn't they understand, did they hear, didn't they hear, was I speaking loud enough, wasn't I speaking loud enough, I had the feeling that if I stopped in the middle of a sentence and went and sat down, nobody would have noticed. It wouldn't have made any difference. So I don't mind repeating it this evening. The Motze Purim, they say, yeah, they say that's the effect of Purim. So the Medrash says, Ata moitzei b'sho she'omar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu lech reid ki shiches amcho. The Medrash on Psol Lecho, when Hashem said to Moshe, go down from the mountain because your people have become degenerate. Hayotofes beluchos v'loy hayomamin shechotu Yisrael. The Medrash says something which is amazingly bold, that Moshe didn't believe Hashem, and he grabbed onto the luchos. Hashem wanted to take the tablets back, and Moshe grabbed onto them and wouldn't let him. And he said, "Lo yamamin shechotu Yisrael. I'm not prepared to believe that Yisrael sinned." Omar im eini roye eini mamin, said Moshe, if I didn't see, I don't believe. I believe what my eyes tell me, I don't believe what I hear secondhand. After all, who's talking to Moshe? Who's giving Moshe this report? Hashem Yisbarach himself. On what basis is there? What basis is there to turn to He who is the definition of all emes, He who is the source of all emes, to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, and to say, I don't believe you? What does that mean, I don't believe you? We get offended if somebody would say to us, if you tell somebody something and he says, I don't believe you, we get offended. And here Moshe Rabbeinu turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself and says, I'm unable to believe you. Haven't seen it? Shenema, as it says, Vayhi kashe, korav Moshe Ramachane, when Moshe came clear near to the camp and he saw them dancing around the golden calf, then he broke the tablets. Shelo shibron ad shero be'enov, he didn't break the luchos until he saw it with his own eyes. The Medrash adds as an aside, how serious it is, those people who give evidence on matters that they didn't see firsthand. And then the Medrash asks the obvious question, is it possible that Moshe didn't believe Hashem? How's that possible? What does it mean, in fact? He says, I don't believe until I see. What better knowledge can there be? Hearing it from Hashem is even better than seeing. There can be no question about it. Elohodia Moshe derech eretz liYisrael. Moshe taught the way of the world to Yisrael. Afilu shehei odom shemeyadova min yechidi neman. Even if a person hears something from a very trustworthy person, but if it's only one person, not two, osu lekabel edusoi lasis dover al pi v'meinu roye. He's not permitted to accept that evidence, to act upon it, unless he's seen it himself. So there are two ways that we can act on evidence. Either we must have seen the thing ourselves, that's not evidence. Either we've seen the occurrence ourselves, then we can act on it. Or it must come from two witnesses. If it comes from one person, we don't act. Obviously, we're talking about a case where the action entails something that could be harmful to others. If the action doesn't entail anything that could be harmful to others, of course we act even on the basis of one person. If one single individual will come in and say, somebody's motor car is being stolen outside, we won't turn to him and say, sorry, we don't believe you. If you're only one aid and the Torah says, Al Pishnaim aid im Yochum Dover, we sure it can't be, then the car can't be stolen. We don't see, we don't believe. We wouldn't say that, we would get up and go and have a look. But if there's a question of damaging somebody else, of our actions having a negative impact on somebody else's life, then we're not permitted to act unless we hear it from two witnesses and we cross-examine the witnesses, then we can act. From one, we can't, no matter how trustworthy that witness is. And that's what Moshe wanted to teach Israel. That not to be offended if they're not accepted as single witnesses. Because even Hashem wasn't accepted as a single witness. And it's no... It must cast no aspersions on the witness or in the integrity of the witness. That's the halacha, and there's nothing we can do about it. But the question that we dealt with last night was, yes, that's very nice and pretty. So Moshe teaches a wonderful halacha to Yisrael that they should know that in future that that's what the Torah says. But why does the Torah say that? That means that the law requiring two witnesses has nothing to do with certainty of accuracy. Because you can have a situation of two witnesses who are not such trustworthy people, but their evidence tallies. They're kosher witnesses, and their evidence tallies. And the Beis Din would be obligated to follow that evidence. On the other hand, you can have the evidence of an absolutely 100% reliable witness, but he's one single witness, and there's nothing we could do. We wouldn't be able to accept it. So if you had two witnesses off the street saying that Reuven stole from Shimon, and we cross-examine them, and we know that they're not such savory characters, these two witnesses, but they're kosher witnesses, they pass the basic requirements. And we cross-examine them carefully, backwards and forwards, and we can't catch them out. And next to them is standing the Chofetz Chaim, and he says, these people are lying. I know, I saw, it's not true. We would have to paskin against the Chofetz Chaim, like the two people, that's the halacha. So we see that the requirement of two witnesses is not to satisfy the truth, not to try and is the purpose of it is not for greater accuracy. There's some other reason for it, because it has no relevance. The accuracy is then not important. What's important is there must be two. And even if one of the witnesses is the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, where there can be no doubt whatever as to the accuracy, we still can't accept the one. Why not? The Chazal say, and it's brought in the beginning of Choshen Mishpat in the Tur. Anybody who judges a law, who sits on a Beis Din and paskins in a matter, emes la'amito, the truth according to his truth, is as if he's made a partner of the Ribbono Shel Olam in the act of creation. That's what Chazal say. What does emes la'amitoi mean? So just the different discussions among the Mefoshim, what does emes la'amitoi mean? Emes, how can there be different degrees of truth? The thing is either true or it isn't true. And the Sma says in the Drisha that emes la'amitoi means that it's not just sufficient to apply the letter of the law with perfect accuracy. A dayan needs to be much more sensitive than that. He's actually got to adapt the law to the circumstances and apply the law in that way. And we've spoken before about the difference between compromise and adapting. That there's such a thing as compromising and adulterating the law, which we're never permitted to do. But there's such a thing as adapting the law, which we're always obligated to do. And the adaptation of halacha, the adaptation of the emes, is the finest skill and the most important element in the living of a Torah life. And I've spoken so often about the incongruences and the instability of a lot of contemporary religious Jewish life. And that is because the contemporary Jewish life is affected to a large degree by the Baal Tshuva movement. And the Baal Tshuva movement is an attempt, by definition, certainly in the early years of Baal Tshuva's involvement, it's an attempt to find a system with zero defect, a system that's perfect. Usually a Baal Tshuva becomes a Baal Tshuva out of disillusionment. He's fed up with the rest of the world. He's found faults with it. And he comes to Torah in the search for perfection. Now this search for perfection is something that is not just a religious phenomenon. This search for perfection is something which applies in the Western world at the moment. It's an insanity, it's a mishugas in the world altogether at the moment, particularly in the United States, where you'll you'll go into a dry cleaner, for example, and there'll be a notice on the wall. The Surgeon General warns you that this establishment uses chemicals which have been found under certain severe circumstances to cause cancer in rats if applied in heavy dosages. That's a mishugas. What difference does it make if that establishment uses a chemical which has caused cancer in rats? I'm not a rat, and it's just irrelevant. Has it ever caused cancer in a human being? No. How many rats have died from cancer with this chemical? Well, they experimented on 5 million rats and 3 died. And how much chemicals did they give them? The equivalent of a human being inhaling it non-stop for 36 years. That's how much they gave the rat. And 3 rats out of 1 million died. So the Surgeon General has to put up a notice. You need to know, it's your constitutional rights. It's not perfect. You need to know there's danger. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but you've got this type of thing on cans of cold drinks now. It doesn't tell you what they contain anymore. It tells you what it doesn't contain. This doesn't contain sugar, and it doesn't contain saccharine, and it doesn't contain this chemical, and it doesn't contain that chemical. All the things it doesn't contain. What it does contain is becoming less important. What's important is the removal of any sign of defect. And they have stripped life of all its, or they're in the process of stripping life of many of the pleasurable things which have risks in them. Life is risky. And if you're going to try and remove risks from life in order to create an environment of zero defect, you're going to have to put everybody in sterilized rooms and not allow people to interrelate to one another, not to talk to one another, not to touch one another. You're going to have to remove all the pleasures and joys of life in order to create something which is zero defect. While I was there once, there was a hue and cry, a little airport where there was a crash, a little aeroplane crashed, and they want to close the airport. Big demonstrations around and people standing with placards to close the airport because of the safety record. And I'm listening to this and watching this. This is interesting. Little town somewhere in nowhere. And they're busy talking about the fact that in the last 5 years there have been, I think it was 37 accidents and 65 or something near accidents. And I'm listening and listening and listening, waiting to hear out of how many landings and taking offs that was. And it was out of hundreds of thousands. At the end of the program, somebody asked that. Hundreds of thousands. So the percentage is minimal. It's not relevant at all. But even 37 accidents out of hundreds and thousands of takeoffs are worrying them because they're seeking an environment with zero defect. They want zero defect in the object, which is really what idolatry is all about. Trying to find an object that is perfect. The Greeks were involved in that. And that's just a continuation of that whole civilization, to try and find an object that is perfect. We try and perfect relationships. We try and perfect the relationship between the subject and the object. We don't look for a perfect object, and we don't look for a perfect subject. There are no perfect human beings, and there are no perfect objects, except the Ribbono Shel Olam. Everything else is a compromise. Everything else has to be adapted. Everything has to be somehow put together, and that's how we create it. What is a shidduch? People so often, and I mention it in all the marriage shiurim, so often people ask and comment, what does a guy like that see in a girl like that? Or very often it's the other way around. What is a girl like that? She's got everything. She's beautiful. She's rich. She's got yichus. She's clever. What does she see in him? He's stupid. He's poor. He has no yichus. He's a failure. And what do they see? What do they see in them? What do they see in each other, sometimes people ask? And it's a silly question, because what there has to be in a shidduch is not perfection in each other. And that's why we find a lot of, in this quest for zero defect, that's why we find a large group of singles. Because each one is looking for zero defect in their spouse. Each one is looking for a woman who has zero defect, and each woman is looking for a man who has zero defect. And the only way I can handle that, and usually when I take a young man or a young lady and I tell them this, they get married very soon afterwards. When I say to them, the kind of person you're describing now, is that the kind of person you want? They say, that's the kind of person you want. You're willing to compromise? No. I said, well, I have bad news for you. I said, I know people like that. Oh, their eyes get big. It's not true, I don't know people like that. But I tell them, I know people like that. But that's the good news. The bad news is they wouldn't look twice at you. What do they want you for? What would such a person want in you? Such a person has got everything. What can you add to such a person's life? And usually very soon after that they start taking shidduchim seriously. A shidduch has to be the creation of perfection between the two. And it is the complementing of the imperfections which create perfection. There cannot be perfection in the object. And so it is, we've got to be careful not to try and find zero defect in the object. It's in the relationships that we try and find perfection. And that's the difference between an appreciation of, well, before that, coming back to the Baalei Tshuva question. Baalei Tshuva come to Torah very often in their quest for zero defect. They want to find a system. They've tried this and they've tried that and they've found something wrong with everything. And they come to Torah now as the perfect system. And then interesting things start to happen. they expose the Torah and it's like a perfect system. As you learn through it, it's wonderful. Everything is perfect. Everything fits together. There is no imperfection. But then real life starts. And then they have disillusionments. They saw a frum person who did something he shouldn't have been done. They saw a rabbi who did something he shouldn't have done. They heard something that they shouldn't have heard. They machlekes, one thing after another, and their world crumbles. And there's disillusionment within Torah as well. And that too is a result, unfortunately, of the quest for zero defect in the object. Of course Torah is perfect, but the world is not perfect and people are not perfect. And we need to be able to adapt Torah to that situation of imperfection. And that's emes la'amito. The Baal Tshuva would like to see the Torah applied in its stringent, absolute terms without any kind of adaption at all. But that creates an abnormality. There is no way that you can take Torah min ha-shamayim, you can take the Ribbono Shel Olam's Torah with all its perfection and apply it, impose it on the world with all its imperfections and expect that to create normal people. It can't create normal people, it creates abnormal people. Religious but abnormal. It should go in. In order to create normal people, there needs to be an adaptation. Not chas v'sholem a compromise. Not chas v'sholem an adulteration. But there has to be an adaptation. And that boundary line between adapting and adulterating, between adapting and compromising, is so minute, it's so fine, that one has to be terribly, terribly careful. But that's called hadan din emes la'amitri. That a dayan has to apply the halacha in a way which fits into the context in which he's working, and he has to apply the halacha there. The halachas one will sometimes paskin for one person that will be different to another person. There are things one would allow in Johannesburg which one would never allow in Bnei Brak. There are things that one would allow in Yerushalayim that one wouldn't allow in Johannesburg. It depends on the environment, it depends on the community, it depends on the people, it depends on the individuals, it depends on the circumstance and the situation. All that has to be taken into account when a shayla is composed and when an answer is given. And we see in that statement of Chazal, kol hadan din emes la'amito, that it's not just a matter of achieving perfection of accuracy in the decision. There's another element to it as well. Amito, there's a subjective element to it as well. And that's what we need to analyze. What is the role of that subjective element? I explained last night that the Torah hates more than anything fake. And fake means presenting something as your own when it's not your own. That's fake. Acting in a way which appears to be yourself when it's not really yourself. You're acting, it's not you. And just as you have fake in objects, you have a fake Rembrandt, you can have a fake diamond, you can have a fake object. So you can have a fake person, or it's not a question of the person being fake, people aren't fake, their actions are sometimes fake. And the essence of a fake action is an action which has been motivated by something other than your own internal system. It has been a compulsion from outside. That's when it can be fake. So if I make you do something that you don't want to do, you're doing it is, it's not you. Something you're compelled to do, it's not you. And there are different ways of being made to do something. We explained last night that when one sees something and one reacts, you see an injustice. You see one man beating another man up and you get angry and you get into it and you pull them apart and you punch the one man in the nose and you pull the other one away and you break up the argument and you do that. Who is that? Is that a genuine action? Of course it's a genuine action. You're excited, you're passionate about it. Usually when there's a bit of passion and excitement about an action, that's usually a simon, that's usually a sign that it's your own, that it's genuine, that this is you acting. When we don't get excited about things that are fake. We don't get excited about things that aren't our own. When we see something and that vision gives rise to a reaction within us, that reaction is genuine. What happens when we hear about something? If you tell me there was a man outside and this one hit this one and they were punching each other and it wasn't justified, it was an injustice, and I get all angry, what am I getting angry at? I'm getting angry at your report. You're telling me something which is making me angry, but I didn't see it. It's not mine, it's not my action. And the chances are that I won't get passionate about it. But even if I do get passionate about it, that passion is fake. There's something wrong in it. What am I getting upset? I didn't see it. I wasn't exposed to it. I heard you. Maybe you're not even telling me the truth. How do I know? We only get excited about things that are our own. Now, there are two ways that a thing can become our own. The one is the emotional way. It's something that we see and we get emotional about it. But the other is where we've worked something out all by ourselves, where we've battled and struggled for something. Anything which is given to us on a golden platter, anything which is given to us for nothing, never really becomes our own. We become attached to those things we toil for, we become attached to those things that we really struggle for. I remember my father telling me years ago about a man who came to see him, very disturbed, that he used to, they were poor people, they used to live in Doornfontein, and he built himself up and he became wealthy, and they moved from Doornfontein to Yeovil and then from Yeovil to Houghton. In those days Houghton was the about as far as one went if one was wealthy, and there was no Sandton and Hyde Park and places like that yet. And he was now a multi-millionaire, and he'd been living in Houghton for many, many years, and his children were all grown up and married and everybody was happy. And he was coming home from work one day and he looked out of his car and he realized he'd driven to the old house in Doornfontein by mistake. He'd gone back to Doornfontein, and he was very troubled by it. He didn't know why. And my father said to him, which was the house where you used to lie awake at night worrying about your business? Doornfontein. Which was the house at which you used to lie up with the children when they were sick, and you used to struggle and you were tired and battling, and you used to take it in shifts? Sometimes you would be up, sometimes your wife would be up. Doornfontein. And so on and so forth. Your struggle for life took place in Doornfontein. Was there any struggle in Houghton? Nothing at all. What's yours, what you feel attached to, is what you struggle for. You don't feel attached to that which comes easily. And that's how we are. Nothing that comes to us easily is something that we feel attached to, that we feel masters of, that we feel is really our own. What was Hashem so antagonistic about Odom eating from the Eitz Hadas? It's rather a selfish thing. The Bnei Shalom has an Eitz Hadas, he has a tree with the power of giving the most wonderful knowledge, and there it is in the garden. He says to Odom, no, but you can't have it. That's Tzaru Sayin, that's rather narrow-minded. Imagine if we had such a thing over here, if we had a sefer in the library that can give tremendous wisdom, teach yourself the whole of Shas. You just have to go through the sefer, it takes a couple of minutes, maybe a tape, a video, and within a few minutes you become a Talmud Chacham. And I say to everybody, you can use any sefer you want in this place. That one, no. That's not for public consumption. Nobody may touch that one. Why not? That's the one that can give you all the Chochmah. What did the Ribbono Shel Olam have against Odom eating from the Eitz Hadas? Too easy. Comes for nothing. Knowledge which is granted for nothing, knowledge which is handed out to you, knowledge which is given to you, is not worth anything. It has to be toiled for, it has to be worked for, in order to become your own. So it is, for a thing to become one's own, one has to work for it. Now you've got a dyer, a judge, sitting in court, and he's got to decide, did A steal from B, didn't A steal from B? A man comes in, very trustworthy, and says, I saw A stealing from B. It was on such and such a day, in such and such a place, this was the circumstance. He describes the scene, and the judge hears it. And let's say you're allowed to paskin on the basis of one witness. The judge would then say, fine, I have to decide, I have to paskin. Man, we've got a witness here, he stole. That's not a judge making a decision on the basis of his own MS, of something he has integrated, as if he saw it himself. Because he has put no effort into it, the judge has been entirely passive. And the concept of MS la mito means that the judge has to be active, not passive, in the determination of truth. And so he has to cross-examine. Now you can't cross-examine one person. To cross-examine you need comparison. And what the judge has to do is he's got to take two different people. And any two different people have different versions, no matter how accurately they're reporting. The fact is, two different people see different things. And he has to take these two different versions and he has to question and analyze until from the two of them he forms a single picture. And then he's allowed to pass. Not because that's more accurate than the one witness. Because the one witness can be the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. It doesn't help. It's not the accuracy we're worried about. It's the genuineness we're worried about. That judgment of yours, Mr. Dayan, did that come from the aid? Or is that your own judgment? Did you feel it? Did you go through it? Did you integrate it? Is the judgment an expression of your feeling and your understanding? Or are you merely transferring what you heard from the witness into a judgment? And to really make it yours, there has to be analysis, there has to be examination, there has to be questioning. And that's something you need two witnesses for. You can't do it with one, no matter how reliable the one is. So we see here a clear preference for genuineness, for active involvement, over accuracy. that we're willing in fact to make a small sacrifice of accuracy in order to gain on the area of genuineness, on the area of it coming from the person himself. It's something we see in many fields. There's no question that a Nikon camera can reproduce a scene with far more accuracy than Van Gogh ever did. But they pay more for the Van Goghs, not only than they pay for Nikon photographs, but even more than they pay for Nikon cameras. And a lot more than they pay for Nikon cameras. Why? If you want an accurate scene of a field of sunflowers, surely the camera does a better job than a Van Gogh. But what we're paying is because we don't want, it's not the accuracy we want. We want to see how Van Gogh saw it, not how anybody else saw it, or not how everybody sees it. We want to see how he saw it. And that's what's important. And when we ask a shiloh of a Talmid Chochem, when we ask a shiloh of a Godel b'Yisrael, it's not just that we want to know, we don't want to hear the same answer that everybody would give. We want to hear the answer he gives, which might well be different to the answer that anybody else would give. We want something which is uniquely his. That's the emes la'amite. That's the taking the emes, taking the truth, fully integrating it, and coming out with a conclusion which is within the parameters of emes, but also including factors of the character and personality of the person who's giving that emes, who's giving that judgment. And that relates back to a medrash that we've often spoken about, and it's so fundamental and so beautiful, where when the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to create the world, there were discussions, there was a debate that took place, and not everybody was happy with it. Chesed omer yiboro shu gomel chasodim. Chesed said, create man, because he'll do kindness. It's a good thing. The emes omer al yiboro shu kulu shkorim. And emes says, don't create man, because man is incapable of perfect truth. There is an inherent deceitfulness in man. There cannot be perfect truth with man. Tzedek omer yiboro shu, he said, tzedokah. Tzedek says, create him, he'll do tzedokah. Shalom omer al yiboro, the kulik toto. Shalom says, there'll never be peace. People argue with one another. There's inevitable conflict. What did the Ribbono Shel Olam do? Not al emes v'yishlichu l'oritz. He took emes, he took truth, and threw it down to the earth. So now he's got two against one. Two who say the man should be created, and only Sholem is a dissenting view, because he expelled one of them. Amru malochei ha'shoris lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so the angel said to Hashem, Ribbono Olam, ma'ato mevaze tachzis al tichzi yosheloch. How can you throw out your most precious emblem, emes, that's everything you stand for. Why is that the one you've thrown out? Out of all of them, that's the one you've thrown out. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, ta'ale emes min ha'aretz. I want truth to come from the earth. I don't want to impose it on the earth. And here we have the fundamental principle of this whole concept. There is an absolute truth which is God's and God's only. We are incapable of that truth. We can't relate to it. It's too perfect for us. It's something we cannot handle. And if the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to maintain that as his standard, he would not be able to create man. That was the issue. Emes says you cannot create man. If you want Emes, there cannot be humanity. So what does Hashem do? His choice is now either don't create man, or to throw Emes down to the earth and say, Emes ta'ale Emes min ha'oretz. That what I want to do is I want Emes to be a product of the human mind. I want mankind to develop Emes. And even if it won't be the same as my emes, it's an emes I'm willing to bind myself to. God himself binds himself, so to say, to the truth that man figures out. And that's what we say in the bracha when we call that to the Torah on Shabbos. Asher nosan lonu toiras emes. Hashem gave us the Torah of emes. That's a contradiction in terms. How can Hashem give us the Torah of emes? The Tosafot Chushan explains this in his introduction. What kind of business is giving me the Torah's emes? If he gave it to us, it's not emes anymore. If he gave it us just to regurgitate, well fine, okay. But he didn't, he gave it to us to be creative in. And if man is going to be creative, surely there's a sacrifice of truth. We can't be creative in the Torah on the same level of truth as the Ribbono Shel Olam is. But that's what Hashem did. V'nosan emes, v'nosan lonu Torah's emes. He gave it to us. V'chaya ilam notar b'secheinu, and he planted it in us for eternity. We do have that capacity to be creative within the framework of truth. And Hashem is willing to sacrifice the zero defect in order to have something which is genuine. There's a difference between something which is perfect and something which is genuine. And the Torah opts for genuineness rather than perfection, provided it's within a framework of acceptability. We can't have something which is genuine and right outside the framework. Obviously not. That we'll discuss in a moment. But provided it's within the framework, the Torah opts for genuineness rather than for perfection. There's that lovely story with Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer in the Gemara, where the Rabbi Yeshua is in the minority, where Rabbi Eliezer is Yeshua is in the minority, and they're all arguing against him, and Rabbi Yeshua brings proofs, and he makes a tree move 100 yards, and he makes the walls of the Beis HaMedrash cave in, and he makes the walls of the Beis HaMedrash stand up straight again. All sorts of wonderful things. Eventually a bas call comes, a heavenly voice comes, and it's Hashem himself speaking, and he says the halach is like Rabbi Yeshua, and the others say, you keep out of it, Ribbono Shel Olam, you gave the Torah to us, and you told us to go by the majority, and the majority hold against you. And the Ran says in the Drosha Saran, in the 7th Drosha, She'achar she'sichlom neitel l'tameh. Question was whether a particular object was tameh or toher, whether it was defiled or it was pure. They said it was tameh. Afal pi she'hayu yedim she'hayu maskimim hefech min ho'emes. Says the Ran, just put yourself in that situation. What is happening? Hashem has told them it's toher. Hashem has said kosher. They have said treif. If you would ask them, what is the emes, gentlemen? What is the truth? How would they have answered? They would have had to have said, the truth is with Hashem, obviously. Hashem says to. Fine. The truth is that it's kosher. And what is your decision, gentlemen? Our decision is that it's treif. Against the truth. Against Hashem. How can you do that? Loirotsu l'tai, they were not willing to change their minds. And had they do that, had they voted with Hashem, they would in fact have been committing an avera. Because the law is, you follow the majority. Hashem gave us the Torah to make our own decisions. And we're not allowed to include heavenly voices and prophecies and all sorts of fancy things in the decisions. There's a halachic methodology that has to be followed. And if that halachic methodology leads us to a conclusion, that conclusion is binding on us and on God. Irrespective of what the absolute perfect emes is, that doesn't concern us. The decision has been put in the hands of the Gedolei Hador, of the leaders of the generation, and their decision is final and binding. Now that's a very important thing for Balei Tshuva to learn. I believe if Balei Tshuva would learn this before they became frum, they probably wouldn't become frum. It's probably a good idea to teach it to them later, because it takes the whole thing away. Then they're becoming frum for zero defect, and what you're saying basically is there is no such thing. There's such a thing as halachic accuracy, and halachic accuracy is the creation resulting from a partnership between man and God. God gave us the Torah and the method. We apply the method to the Torah and to the circumstances. We reach conclusions, and those conclusions are halachically binding. Are they absolutely true? We don't know, and we don't care. That's irrelevant. We know how to reach those conclusions, and those conclusions are binding. The truth, Hashem then adapts himself to our decisions, not the other way around. That's the partnership that has been created between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's the partnership of Kol Hadam Din Emes La'amitoi. Anybody who judges a judgment which is true, La'amitoi, according to his own truth too. There's an internal integrity as well. Kilu Nase Shutofo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's as if he's become a partner in the Ribbono Shel Olam in the creation of the world. That is the partnership. That's the ultimate of creativity. There is a difference in creativity between invention and discovery. Both are creative activities. But there's a difference between invention and discovery. And the term that we use for creativity in Torah is chidush. Now chidush doesn't really mean creativity. Chidush means renewal. That means taking something old and making it look new. That's really what a chidush is. Bringing a new angle onto something old. Our involvement in Torah is not one of inventiveness. Our involvement in Torah is one of discovery. There's a big difference between discovery and inventiveness, both in method and in the effect it has on the person. Inventiveness creates arrogance in the person. Discovery creates humility in the person. When you discover something, you say to yourself, my goodness, look at this, and I didn't even realize what was involved. Look how big it is. Look how wonderful it is. Discovery creates humility in the human being. Invention creates arrogance in the human being. Look how big I am. Look what I discovered. Look what the world didn't know, and I've now taught it. So the invention, in fact, detracts from human stature, and discovery adds to human stature. Mr. Leonard Gordon asked me in shul this morning, why Moshe comes down from the mountain and his face is beaming. He's got these beams of light coming off his face. But that was after the second luchos. Why not after the first ones? Why was it only after the second set of of Luchos, that Moshe's face shone with these tremendous beams of radiance, and they weren't there after the first Luchos. So there must be something in the second Luchos that the first ones didn't have. The Netziv says the second Luchos was a partnership between man and God, whereas the first Luchos was God alone, which is the first obvious difference. The first Luchos were a handout, it was a gift, and the people were meant to be able to rise to that occasion. And if we stop there for a moment, that begins, we're able to understand a lot of difficult things with that. What is one of the biggest difficulties on this parasha, which must bother us, and is part of the subject of the book of Shoftim, which we're learning with the ladies at the moment? These people who danced around the golden calf, what had happened to them only days before? Nevuah, prophecy. They had stood at the foot of Mount Sinai, they'd seen the Torah being given, they'd heard God's voice saying, Anochi Hashem Elokeichem. They'd come out of Egypt, they'd seen the Red Sea split, they'd been through the 10 plagues. They'd got all that wealth on the other side, they've been eating mon, they've seen the Be'er Shel Miriam, they've seen the water miracles. They've been living in an environment with daily unbelievable miracles. And they're dancing around a golden calf. And that's something that bothers us today as well. One scud fired at the Americans killed 29. 39 scuds fired at Israel killed 2. Now how can one not become religious after that? After this whole war and everything that's gone up, and go back and think of the fears before and what people thought and what people were worried about, and just look at what's happened day after day. The whole thing doesn't make sense. How can one remain secular after that? But people do. Nobody's really changed. People talk a little bit more, with a little bit more awe and respect, and I'm told the atmosphere in Israel is a little bit better, but nobody's going to become, no large numbers of people are going to become frum because of this, going to sit in yeshiva and learn Torah because of this. What's happening? Why is it that miracles don't have effects on people? We think to ourselves sometimes, if we would see the Red Sea split, look how frum we would be. If we would see the Torah being given, what we would only do. If we got mon every day, how religious we would be. The truth is, we would be no different to the way we are now. It would have no effect on us whatever. If mon came tomorrow morning, if there was even a bus call before, a heavenly voice came at this minute and said, Rabbi Isa, you don't have to work anymore. Because from tomorrow morning there's going to be mon. Whatever you need, you're going to get mon. Morning and afternoon. And the mon came in the morning, and the mon came in the afternoon, morning, afternoon, every single day. We wouldn't be on any higher religious standard than we are at the moment. It would have no effect on us whatsoever. And we see it had no effect on them. How is that possible? The answer, something that's given to you doesn't affect you. We are not affected by anything that's given to us, by anything that's imposed upon us, by anything by which we're compelled. We're not affected by it. It doesn't change us. It's dramatic. It has enormous impact for a moment or two. But it doesn't change us. We're not changed by things we're given. We're not changed when we're passive. The only thing that can change us is when we become active. They have these passive exercises. I don't know if they work or not. My wife says they work. But I don't know. They seem to me to be contrary to the very essence of everything. How can you possibly gain from something where you do nothing? It doesn't work that way. The world is not created that way. Just as for everything, you've got to do something. And the more you do, the more you gain. There is nothing you can gain from doing nothing. And anything you get for nothing has no effect on you. You don't change. Like the example I always give with the jacuzzis, trying to make the effect of swimming while you remain stationary by making the water pass you. But the fact is, at the end of the day, it makes you feel like you're swimming. But at the end of the day, the fact is you've stayed in one place. You haven't changed. It was illusions of movement. It was feelings of movement. You can say what you like. But at the end of the day, you've stayed in one place. And so it is with miracles. Miracles are just a big jacuzzi. All sorts of things happening around and about you. But you're staying stationary. You're not moving. You're doing nothing. And if you're doing nothing, you're not affected by it. The first luchos were created for an environment that theoretically, for a zero defect environment. If it was a zero defect environment, then we could be affected by things around and about us. We wouldn't have to be active. The reason we have to be active is because of our defects. And that's why the first luchos didn't work. The second luchos had to come by. What was the second luchos? God dictated, Moshe wrote. There's a partnership. This is man and God together creating the Torah. And that's the basis of all the Torah that followed afterwards. It has to be a partnership between man and the Ribbono Shel Olam. Discovery, not invention. Invention is man alone. Compulsion is God alone. Discovery is man and God together. When people are discovering, they're involved in something godly. And discovery is something we should be involved in at all times. In our marriages we should be involved in discovery. With our children we should be involved in discovery. Looking around the world we should be involved in discovery. Reading the newspaper we should be involved in discovery. Learning a Blat Gemara we should be involved in discovery. Everything we do, there should be a dimension of discovery. Let me find something in this that nobody saw before, at least that I didn't see before. Let me find Chidush, let me find that which is new in it. Let me discover something. And that discovery creates tremendous freshness in the human being. And that is partnership between man and God. God says, I give you the raw material. You discover something in it. And that's why a Van Gogh can raise so much more money than a photograph. Because a photograph does not discover anything. It merely reproduces. An artist discovers a dimension in a scene which the ordinary person missed. And that's exciting. That's something very important. A poet does the same. A great literary writer does the same. A philosopher does the same. A scientist does the same. Any creative person, if it's a discovery type of creation rather than an inventive type of creation, if it's a discovery type of creation, he's finding something, a dimension, an element, a link which everybody else has missed. And that discovery is very exciting, and that's an excitement which needs to be in life at all times, continuously, all day and every day. How do we do it? There's a wonderful medrash which the Or HaChaim HaKadosh brings on this question of Moshe's face shining after the second luchos, not the first. The medrash Rabbi Yehuda Bar Nachman Omar, in the medrash of Rabbi Yehuda Bar Nachman it says, "Kishekosav Moshe haTorah, when Moshe finished writing the Torah, nishtayir bekulmos kimo, there was a tiny bit of ink left in the pen. He finished the last words of Torah, and there was still a little bit of ink left in the pen." He passed the pen over his head, and that produced the beams of light, the beams of glory. What does it mean? Explains the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, why was the ink left in the pen? Because Moshe didn't use all the ink he was supposed to use. Hashem clearly would have given Moshe just the right amount of ink. There's no point in giving him more or less. He would have given him exactly the right amount of ink. So if there was ink left in the pen, that shows there are things that Moshe left out. What did Moshe leave out? So there are a few examples. In Vayikra, for example, it says Vayikra, Vav, Yud, Kuf, Reish, Aleph, and Moshe wrote a small Aleph, not a big Aleph. Because in the case of Bilam, it says Vayaker. When Hashem meets Bilam, it says Hashem chanced upon him. But when it comes to Moshe, it says Hashem called out to Moshe. And Moshe, in his modesty, felt that looked too arrogant. He couldn't bring himself to write Vayikra, so he was going to write Vayaker, the same as with Bilam. But it was a chance meeting. Hashem happened to find him, not that it was a destined meeting. And Hashem said, no, I said Vayikra with an Aleph, so Moshe compromises and he writes a little Aleph. Hashem must have given him enough ink to write a big Aleph with. And he wrote a little Aleph, there was ink left over. It says, Vayish Moshe, Onov Moed Mikolodom. Moshe was more modest than any man. Onov should be spelt Ayin Nun Yud Vov, and in the Torah it's spelt Ayin Nun Vov. Says this Medrash, Moshe left out the Yud to contract the size of that word modest, to make it even more modest. He couldn't bring himself to write that phrase, and Hashem insisted, but he left out the Yud. Still reads the same, but it's a contracted Yud. You read it more quickly, you get over it faster. He didn't want anybody to dwell on it. So Hashem gave him enough ink for the Yud, and that ink was left over. And that's the ink which created the light on his face. What does that mean really? What does Or HaChaim mean? There was creativeness and discovery even in the written law that Moshe took down by dictation. When I was being questioned by a certain Rosh Hashiva, we wanted to know whether I was creative or not. So you can't ask a person, are you creative? So he said, do you ever write things? I said, yes, sometimes I write. He says, when you finish writing, are you satisfied with it as it is? I say no. Then I make alterations. He says, when you've made the alterations, do you ever rewrite it? I say yes. I made alterations, then I rewrite it. He said, and when you've rewritten it, are you happy or do you make more alterations? I said, I make more alterations. And he was happy, then he was satisfied. Even a creative person doesn't, you're never satisfied. You can't copy something down. Even when you've copied it, there's got to be something of yours on it. We had a lovely reading of the Megillah on Purim evening. What was so lovely about it? What was so special about it? It was unique. Nobody else read the Megillah like that particular person does. It was his reading. He put his understanding, his interpretation. We've become used not only in our shul, in all shuls, to a Kriyas HaTorah which is sterile. It's merely a statement, a dull going through the Sedra, following, and even if it's accurate, and in our shul we can't really claim that, and most shuls can't really claim a great deal for its accuracy, but even if it's 100% accurate, how authentic is it? There's a difference. Accurate is one thing, it must be accurate, fine. But how authentic is it? How much does one feel the Baal Kore knows what he's reading, loves it, and is trying to transmit his understanding of it? With a bit of drama, with a bit of feeling, with pauses at the right place, with a bit of up and a bit of down, questions, answers, read it in a way which makes it exciting. Very seldom does one ever hear. That's a great Baal Kore. Baal Kore, when you listen to it, and you get an interpretation by the way he reads it. We had it on Purim night, that we had it. The way the Megillah was read, there was an interpretation. Doesn't matter whether you agree with the interpretation or not, that's not what's important. What's important is it's within the framework of authenticity, it's not at the sacrifice of emes, of truth and accuracy, and it's genuine, it's a human being doing his own thing, it's not copied, it's not fake. Even in Moshe's copying of the Torah in dictation, imagine the scene, Hashem dictating to Moshe. And if I would ask you, after Hashem had dictated to Moshe, would you expect there to be any variances between the dictated material and the final product? You would answer, no, Moshe would never deviate and Hashem, it would be perfect. But it wasn't, there were differences, there was creativity even in that. Onov is spelt without a yud. Vayikra is spelt with a little aleph. That's not how Hashem dictated it, that's how Moshe wrote it. And Hashem was prepared to accept it. Hashem was prepared to sacrifice accuracy for genuineness and authenticity. Because that's Torah, that's Moshe. Now this is Moshe's Torah too. There's the partnership. That even in the written word, there's the stamp of Moshe on it. That's what this Medrash means. And that stamp, represented by the ink that was left over in the pen, is what gave him the light, the beams of light. The first set of tablets didn't have that. The first set of tablets had nothing of Moshe in them. The first set of tablets were handed to man. They had nothing of mankind in them. That brings no change to man. Man doesn't change when he's given something. Moshe didn't change when he was given that Torah. The second Torah that he had to work for, that he had to toil for, that he put the stamp of his own personality on, there his face changes. It's not the same Moshe that comes down. This is a changed person. And Hashem wants to see that change in us. Hashem wants to see that partnership between us and him. And he's willing to sacrifice minute deviations from perfection, from zero defect, in order to have genuineness, warmth, authenticity, the real thing coming from within the human being. But finally, we've got to note, what were those changes? They were changes that involved a diminishment of the personality, not an imposition of the personality. And that's the difference between invention and discovery. Invention is when you impose yourself on the object. Discovery is when you remove yourself from the object. If you'll just remove yourself a little bit from what you're doing, you'll see all sorts of beautiful things that you never saw before. If you impose yourself on what you're doing, you miss it all. If you're self-centered, if you're aware of yourself and conscious of yourself, you miss all the beautiful things. What Moshe, the stamp, if we look at the stamp of Moshe's personality, so we're going to say, right, where was the deviation? Where did Moshe express his own personality? The Aleph goes to a small Aleph. It's not Vayikra, it's Vayakir. Onov is smaller than Hashem printed, than Hashem dictated it. They're all diminishments of Moshe's personality. In that lies the discovery, when we're able to diminish ourselves. And that applies in relationships between people. If you just remove yourself from the relationship a little bit, if the relationship is based on my rights and what I'm entitled to you, and are you showing me enough kovod, and are you sensitive to my needs, and don't you notice that I get hurt by that? If that's the emphasis of the relationship, you're not going to notice the beauty in the other person at all. You're not going to discover anything in the other person. The moment there's a diminishment of self and involvement in the other. What are that person's needs? Am I fulfilling that person's needs? What hurts that person? Then you start discovering and feeling all sorts of things which you didn't know before. And so it applies in every area. If you're looking at a beautiful view, if you're looking at a sunset, if you're looking at a beautiful bed of flowers, the more you can forget yourself, the more you'll notice what you're looking at, what's taking place around and about you. The more you're focusing on yourself, the less you're going to notice what's taking place around and about you. It's the same in a shiur. You'll find, when do you really understand and enjoy a shiur? When you didn't notice the time going by. When you didn't, and it's not the other way around. It's not the time. I didn't notice the time going by because I was enjoying the shiur. It's the other way around. I lost myself. And having lost myself, I enjoyed the shiur. When you're reading a book, when you lose yourself in it, you don't notice time going by, you're enjoying it. Why are you enjoying it? Because you've allowed yourself to lose yourself in it and to become totally involved in it. If one can release oneself, if one can remove that ego and allow oneself to become involved in that object, one finds the discovery. Then you come out with things that nobody else knew, that nobody else realized, that you yourself are able to see. Because that's a true merging of your unique personality with that object, and that creates something new, unique and different. And that is the second luchos. Those are the second tablets, the basis of the Torah that we have. Not a zero defect object handed out by God and compelled upon man. Not something invented by man, full of flaws, of inaccuracies, of deceit and deviations. This is something where the Ribbono Shel'olam gives us the frame. The Ribbono Shel'olam gives us the material. The Ribbono Shel'olam gives us the method. And he tells us to be productive and to be creative. And to make out of that something which is a combination of him and us. Something which combines his kedusha with our minds, his sanctity with our intellects. To produce chidushei Torah, to produce understandings and perceptions of the Torah, which are new in their freshness. And while they're not inventions in the sense of lacking any kind of truth and accuracy and self-aggrandizement, they are discoveries every single day. Each day we're involved in the Torah and in the world in general, there should be a newness and a freshness as we apply ourselves to it.